This is audiobook in MP3 audio files, of parts of about 30 minutes each, of My Life in Two Worlds, by Gladys Osborne Leonard. If not finding Word or PDF document of this, then format this text document yourself in Word or a similar program. This is also a way to learn these teachings. Foreword. By Sir Oliver Lodge. This seems to me to be a useful and much needed book full of information not easily accessible. It represents fairly and truly the feelings and interpretations of a sensitive's experiences, and contains material for psychological study. It also represents the difficulties encountered by a would-be medium at this stage of the world's knowledge of their subject, when she is constantly in danger of prosecution for breaking what the courts consider to be the law. Taking it at its face value, her narrative proceeds on their conviction of the reality of a spiritual world with which it is possible under certain conditions to get into contact. She is inclined to think, and I am too, that the denizens of that world are all round about us, but that their presence is inaccessible to us unless we have an instrument of reception, just as we are unaware of the etheric waves sent out from Daventry and other stations, though they only require a properly attuned instrument for their interpretation into speech and music. To communicate with their spiritual world, most of us require the services of a human being with an organism trained to allow itself to be used by other intelligences, who are thus able to demonstrate their existence and to send messages of affection or comfort. Mrs. Leonard is such a medium, and has proved herself in the past to be the best or one of the best that I have known. Thoughtless people often object to the use of a medium, and wonder why they cannot get into touch themselves. They forget that for many mundane purposes a medium is necessary. Most people are quite incompetent either to receive or send a telegram without the help of an operator, who acts like a medium. We are all provided with suitable apparatus for both sending and receiving messages of a customary kind, as by writing or speech. It is only when we attempt to communicate with people whose existence is uncertain, and who can only be got at in an unfamiliar way, that doubts and difficulties arise. Our sense organs are so adapted that we can easily get into touch with intelligences inhabiting the material world, although their term of vitality is comparatively evanescent. My belief is that the etheric world is inhabited by a multitude of beings just as various as those we have grown accustomed to on this mundane sphere, but since they make no impression on our senses, they for the most part elude our ken. The full magnitude of intelligent existence therefore escapes us, and we concentrate on their small portion of the universe readily available. To go beyond that involves dangers, just as does any exploration, but we are warned against them, and it is possible for any sane and wholesome and well-intentioned person to select, under beneficent guidance. Mrs. Leonard has been prompted to write this book in order to inform us how the whole subject appears to a person endowed with the requisite faculty, and her narrative cannot fail to be instructive even to those who are inclined to interpret the experiences differently. For myself, I am content with the straightforward interpretation that things are, on the whole, like what they appear to be, and I have tried to show that this is not out of accord with the doctrines of modern physics. Be that as it may, everyone will surely be grateful to a person endowed with exceptional faculties for recording her sensations and what she thinks to be her experiences, in a simple and interesting manner. With a great deal of her trance utterances, which have proved of help and comfort to thousands, she is perforce ignorant, since she herself is entranced during their reception, but she has accumulated plenty of other information, and sets it forth for what it may be worth. I think that thereby she has performed a very considerable service to psychical research, and I thank her cordially for the effort. 17th of June 1931. Chapter 1. Yesterday's Sunbeam. And we too live and pass, reflecting for one moment and in the measure of our capacity the light and wonder of the eternal. And is that not enough? I read these words in the Sunday Express of January 1, 1928. They were the concluding words in an article on immortality by Mr. H.G. Wells. In a preceding paragraph entitled Yesterday's Sunbeam, Mr. Wells stated that there men of doctor have lived and passed like the light upon the specks in yesterday's sunbeam. And all that is left today of drive, the ancient, are mounds of rubbish and disused and worn out things, and all its individual lives are but a fading memory. The italics are mine. Those words seemed to me to be dreadfully sad. They are not in accordance with the mass of irrefutable evidence that has been collected during recent years by many careful and intelligent investigators regarding human survival after death. The individual lives of doctors still persist, just as the individual lives of all the men who lived and passed in the Great War of a few years ago, the mother who passed last year, the father or husband, or son or daughter, of any one of us who passed last month, or last week, or yesterday, persist. Not one of these individual lives will exist only as a fading memory. The facts and evidences that have been collected have proved to us that each of these individual lives persists, still as individuals, after the soul has left the physical body, but Mr. Wells, and many thousands like him, have not developed the perfectly normal faculty of clairvoyance, or clairaudience, and cannot see or hear the loved one who has passed to his new condition of body and being, and therefore, because they cannot perceive him with their physical sight, they simply deny his existence. Supposing these skeptical folk had been born deaf, would they have denied their existence of music because they themselves had not the faculty with which to hear it? Would they not accept the word of all the countless people who have heard, or would they judge their statements as merely evidence of hallucination or delusion in otherwise well-balanced and reasonable human beings whose opinion would be accepted on any and every other subject? And we too live and pass, reflecting for one moment and in the measure of our capacity the light and wonder of the eternal. And is that not enough? Asks Mr. Wells. No, no. It is not enough. It is not enough for those who have loved, and who miss the daily companionship, the affection and understanding and sympathy of the loved one, who seems to have been snatched away from us by the process called physical death. 6. Are they, our loved ones, to be thought of only as yesterday's sunbeams? Now, as this book is a record of personal experiences, I am forced to speak of myself all through. Every page will be dotted with a great many I's, and probably bristle with split infinitives and other grammatical and literary errors, but one can speak of one's own experiences more easily than one can of other people's. In one part of this volume I propose to give some of the evidence that led me to believe in spiritualism, and in another part to give, to the best of my ability, some instructions with regard to the development of the psychical faculties. I think the time has come when there should be a medium in every home, perhaps every member of the family could develop not to the exclusion of other interests and duties, but as an additional gift, a faculty which can, and should, augment and help every action, word, and thought in our daily lives. I myself have not found that the development of psychic awareness detracts in any way from other so-called normal studies. I am a more successful gardener than I used to be. I am a much better cook, in many quite ordinary, but extremely useful directions, I know. I have improved, My health and nerves are under better control, therefore they are more to be relied upon than they ever were before I developed what many people think of as an abnormal or extraordinary power. A lady remarked, on meeting me for the first time, but knowing that I was a medium, "Good gracious, Mrs. Leonard, you look quite sensible." I feel sure she had expected to see me with straws in my hair, and a distraught and Ophelia-ish expression. It is the knowledge of what spiritualism has done for me spiritually, mentally, and even physically, that impels me to try, in this simple book, to show others how to grasp the truth of personal survival, and to benefit it by the added hope and courage that it gives. One with which to tackle the difficulties and trials of everyday life, and to face calmly, even hopefully, the apparent tragedy called death, which the majority are poor human beings banish from their minds as much and as long as possible. It is not so much one's own death, though that seems to present terrors of the unknown to quite a large number of people, as the fear of losing a near and dear relative or friend, and their dreadful sense of loss that comes with the silence, that terrible silence that follows the passing of the loved one, for those who are left, and who wait. When some beloved voice that was to you both sound and sweetness, faileth suddenly, and silence against which you dare not cry aches round you like a strong disease and new. What hope, what help, what music will undo that silence to your sense? Not friendship's sigh, not reason's subtle cant, not melody of viols, nor of pipes that Faunus blew, not song of poets, nor of nightingales, whose hearts sleep upward through the cypress trees to the clear moon, nor yet the spheric claws self-chanted, nor the angel's sweet all hails melt in the smile of God. Nay, none of these speak thou, availing Christ, and fill this pause. E.B. Browning. Spiritualism has helped to fill the pause for thousands of people, giving them back their lost faith, their hope of eternity, and reunion with those they love. Chapter 2, A Friend Disappears. People frequently ask me, what caused you to think of becoming a medium? In their first place, what was it that brought the subject of communication and survival to your mind? The cause dates back to when I was a child, probably 8 years old. I had always been carefully guarded by my parents against hearing anything about death, accidents, or anything unpleasant. Newspapers were carefully kept out of the children's way. As it happened, we had not had a death in our family, or even among our intimate friends. Now, on Sunday mornings, after we had been to church, my father and I carried out a regular program week after week, over quite a long period. We walked across the fields and through the country lanes to visit a friend of my father's, whose name, I think, was Underwood. At any rate, I will call him by that name. Mr. Underwood was a man of about 40, of the hale and hearty type, very fond of gardening and outdoor life. He used to take us round his garden on each visit and exhibit his plants, roses, etc., with great pride. Mr. Underwood, with his love of detail, tidiness, and enthusiasm for all living things, had become a kind of institution in my small life. He belonged to, was an essential part of, my world of everyday tangible things. He ranged with the morning bath, breakfast, prayer, lessons, and everything that one expected would go on tomorrow as it is today, and was yesterday. Then came one Sunday morning. My father and I set out as usual. It was a bright sunny morning, and I quite looked forward to seeing our friend's pretty garden again. When we reached the house, we noticed the blinds were all drawn. That seemed strange, for the family liked sun and air. my father knocked at the door, which was opened by the usually cheerful parlor maid, with tear-stained face. She said at once, "Oh, sir, Mr. Underwood, he's gone." My father, taken aback, repeated, "Gone?" "Yes, gone, died in the night, his bad cold, that he didn't take much care of, turned to pneumonia and he's gone." My father went into the house, leaving me in the garden, saying he would only be a few moments. I walked round the paths. I saw the same plants, the same trees, the same grass that I had seen the previous Sunday. The same dog that walked round with us. He was there. Everything was there, just the same, but the central figure, the bulwark of the whole scene, was not there. It seemed unbelievable. I looked round corners, behind trees, in the greenhouse, half expected him to appear suddenly, bearing a familiar flower pot and showing us his latest treasure, but nothing happened. 9. My father came from the house. In silence he took my hand, and we trudged quietly on our homeward way. I felt as if I were choking with an extraordinary fear, and a kind of dreadful curiosity that must be satisfied, or something in me would burst. "Dada, where is Mr. Underwood?"
"He's gone, dear."
"Gone where?"
"Don't ask questions, dear. You will understand better later on. He has gone to heaven."
"But why has he gone to heaven? Did Mrs. Underwood want him to go?"
"No, dear. If she didn't want him to go, isn't she dreadfully frightened and miserable?"
"Yes, I'm afraid she is very upset about it."
"But why did he go, if she didn't want him to go?"
"I don't know, dear. Don't keep asking questions." The rest of the walk was taken in silence, a terrible walk, full of new, vague and strange dreads. 2 days later I noticed that my father did not leave home to go to his office at the usual time. Instead he dressed himself in unusually somber garb, and left the house at a much later hour. I watched him go from the nursery window, and immediately my morning lessons were over. I hurried down to the kitchen, where I was not, as a rule, allowed to be. I got hold of a housemaid, one who had only been with us a short time, and asked her where my father had gone. She said, "To Mr. Underwood's funeral."
"What's that?"
I asked. "Well, they're burying him today."
"Burying, burying,
burying Mr. Underwood. Oh. Dreadful thought."
"Yes, of course, same as they bury everybody who dies, silly.
Where do they bury him?"
"In a grave, under the earth."
"Under the earth, deep down, where he can't get out if he wants to."
"Of course he can't get out.
Not he.
Come on now. Stop asking questions. I want to get on with my work."
"Wait a minute, Ellen, I must know. Does everybody have to be buried? Does everybody
go, so that they must be buried, and never come up again, never?"
10. "You're a naughty girl, Miss Gladys. Don't you remember anything about the resurrection? They come up, then, when the last trump sounds,
of course."
"Oh. They do come up?
A ray of hope.
When, for how long must they be buried before the trump?"
"Till the end of the world, as it tells you in the prayer book, if you'd got the sense to
remember."
"The end? The very end?
The end of the world? Oh, endless arrays of birthdays, Christmas days, and other long-waited-for events and times, that between each one seemed to stretch eternity. And now I'm told that it's all my birthdays and all other dates. And thousands more, countless thousands.
No, it's impossible to grasp. I must find out for
myself.
How, where,
I don't know, but I must find out."
A still more terrible thought arises, one that will not be suppressed. It is more devastating than any, to my childish mind. Ellen, only one more question. Someday, will my mother go, and have to be buried? Of course she will, and your father, and me, and you, and everybody. It's the way of the flesh, as you ought to have learned, going to church regular, and everything, like you do. You don't seem to have learned anything. You are a backward girl, and so on. Beyond this I didn't listen. Life itself had become a nightmare. Where was there any possible joy in anything? The garden, the swing, the familiar games after tea that hitherto we had all been blindly enjoying, unconscious of this horrible fate overhanging us. How could I ever again see beauty or happiness in anything? When playing their previously enjoyed game of ball on the lawn, with my mother as active and full of life as any one of us children, I used suddenly to stop dead, look at her, and remember that at any time she might mysteriously go, like Mr. Underwood, and then she would be buried, my beloved, alive, and vital mother. So I carefully read the order for the burial of the dead, but I could not understand it. Though worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, was incomprehensible to my child mind. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. It all seemed so involved, so contradictory, and hopeless. About this time my mother had an illness lasting for some months, and during this period I was allowed to go to church on Sunday mornings by myself. As our own rather High Church of England service had failed to give me any definite spiritual consolation regarding the fears and dreads that I experienced, I tried every other church, of every 11 denomination, for miles around. Most ingenious were the fibs I had to tell to account for my late return from our own church, to which I was naturally supposed to have been, and which was only a short distance from home. As most children do, I kept my imaginings to myself for fear that people would laugh at me. In later years I have talked to men and women of all ages, and many have told me that in their childhood they were beset and harassed with fears very similar to my own. Childhood to me was a time of pain and torture rather than the care, free, merry time it is usually supposed to be, and I know that many sensitive children have gone through the same experience. In the spiritualist movement there is one part of the organization devoted to children. Services are held that are specially thought out as being helpful, explaining the process of transition from the physical to the spiritual state, in a perfectly natural and simple manner. These services are part of the Lyceum movement, as it is called, and I often think of the misery I should have been saved if I had known of this organization while I was young. It was a wonder that I did not become a very nervous and morbid child, but I was a voracious reader. Sometime between the years of 7 and 10, I read Shakespeare, Byron, Dickens, Zola, and everything I could lay hands and eyes on. I must mention here rather a curious thing. My father had strong ideas regarding education. He thought it wrong to make a child learn anything in a scholastic way before the age of 8. At 6 years old I surreptitiously taught myself to read. How I managed it I cannot now realize, but by cutting out large print from magazine covers, and making secret and hurried visits to the kitchen where I pestered the maids with questions as to what letter of the alphabet it was, and for what word it would stand, I did so. Even there, postman was called upon to help, in fact, anybody whom I could rely upon not to give me away to my parents. Well, somehow or other I taught myself to read, and before I was 8 years of age, I must have devoured an extraordinary collection of literature at any times when I could be alone. Books of my father's used to be hidden in a fork in there. Branches of a large apple tree, and even in the gutterways running under the eaves of the house, where I had to get a high ladder and climb quite a terrifying way in order to secrete and recover my book when I needed it. Two or three books were ruined by being saturated with water, but I was never found out as being the delinquent. One would think that much of the strange material which I read must have been incomprehensible to me, but it is extraordinary, looking back, to realize how much I did understand. Byron's Manfred, Dickens' Dombey and Son, Zola's Nana, and many other works that small children usually know nothing about were, in some curious way, digested and assimilated by my mind to an extraordinary degree. Chapter 3, The Happy Valley. Something else of an entirely spiritual and psychic nature was being given to me at this time. Every morning, soon after waking, even while dressing or having my nursery breakfast, I saw visions of most beautiful places, in whatever direction I happened to be looking. The physical view of wall, door, ceiling, or whatever it was, would disappear, and in its place would gradually come valleys, gentle slopes, lovely trees and banks covered with flowers of every shape and hue. The scene seemed to extend for many miles, and I was conscious that I could see much farther than was possible with the ordinary physical scenery around me. The most entrancing part to me was the restful, velvety green of the grass that covered the ground of the valley and the hills. Walking about, in couples, usually and sometimes in groups, were people who looked radiantly happy. They were dressed in graceful flowing draperies, for the greater part, but every movement, gesture, and expression suggested in an undefinable and yet positive way, a condition of deep happiness, a state of quiet ecstasy. I remember thinking to myself, how different they are, how different from the down here people, how full of love and light and peace they are. No fear, or doubt, or dreadful mystery is there. It all looked too expressive of life and joy to be in any way connected with the unsatisfactory state in which I mentally lived. That place, I answered, pointing to the dining room wall, which was bare except for a couple of guns hanging on it. What are you talking about? My father asked. I tried to explain, which brought the whole family and household around me in a great state of anxiety and annoyance. At first they thought I was making it up, but as I was so persistent, and described many of the visions so minutely, they were forced to the conclusion that there was something in it, something which was not in line with their conventional way of looking at things. I was sternly forbidden to see or look for the Happy Valley again. You must understand that my family were very orthodox in their beliefs. They believed in a heaven of harps and crowns, kept specially for those who refrained from probing into things they were never meant to understand. I do not know whether it was the collective suggestion of every single mind around me, parents, doctors, and friends, but certainly, little by little, my visions disappeared. This was a great deprivation. I was conscious of a definite spiritual vacuum. I cannot 13. Describe it in any other words. In many ways I had a practical, sensible brain. I've still got it after 18 years of strenuous psychic work. I, and a sense of self-preservation, impelled me to put the feeling of loss on one side. I tried to feel as Wordsworth wrote, what though the radiance which was once so bright be now forever taken from my sight? Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. But I know I did not get the best out of, or put my best into, what remains behind. It was simply getting through things as well as I could, becoming harder and more.